Okay, so today I think we're going to have, I'm going to do about an hour, and then Joyce Gutzik is going to talk a little bit about some of her models for how you might eject mass by pulsations. So yesterday we heard a lot. First of all, let me note that I think today is hump day for the workshop. It's the equal number of days before, scientific days before and after, so we're halfway through. I'm here for the whole duration, so I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot about binaries and supernovae. And what I'm really trying to do is find ways to hook up with people in those communities to talk about what can happen when you have a large amount of energy added to a star, either through some kind of interior explosion. So the basic scenario is the one that sort of follows something that Elliot talked about in an earlier talk that we had a few weeks ago. Many of you were here, but some of you weren't. Where you add energy above, at some layer that's below the surface that's still optically thick, but that is enough to exceed the Eddington limit. And what kind of outflow, what kind of mass loss, what happens when you do that? So, now, because, there's the saying that for somebody with a hammer, everything is a nail. And so, for me, I've been studying steady state, more or less quasi-steady state mass loss for going on 30, 40 years, I think. It's, 1980s, mid-1980s. And, what I would like to argue is that many situations in which you might have, say, well, first of all, if you have a supernova, the energy is so much that it just blows the envelope away. And that's clearly not a wind. That's basically just an explosion. It can be modeled by like a set-off type model or whatever. But in many situations you might have, we've heard about, where the amount of energy deposited inside of the star is not enough to unbind the envelope. And then you would expect that maybe there'll be a prompt response where you'll lose some mass, but then the star will have to relax to the fact that the envelope collapses back down. And during that time, energy is being released and over a longer time scale, longer than the dynamical time scale. And under many circumstances, the luminosity during that time might be above the Eddington limit. And if you might expect to get a kind of a super Eddington mass loss. And that's what I'm going to try to talk about today. The idea is that we really need to focus on both the energy and momentum. But because it's optically thick, it turns out the radiation pressure can play a dynamical role in mediating the transfer of energy into the flow. And so I'm going to talk about that. That's something that was actually kind of at odds between models that Elliot had done and models that I had done. But now I think we've understood, based on some nice discussions we've had during the first 5 weeks, how to resolve that. And that goes a lot to help from Rich Townsend, who helped solve a couple of equations that come about. But I think in general, what we can expect when you have a super Eddington wind is that it won't be fine-tuned to be able to actually be sustained. And therefore, you'll get flow stagnation, and it'll lead to super Eddington turbulence or convection that's also supersonic, and therefore has a lot of density fluctuations. And porosity will play a big role in mediating what happens at that point. And in order to really model that, we need 3D radiation hydrosimulations like Jan Fay does. And I've also been talking to Chris Fryer about using codes from Los Alamos to try to model that. Okay, so the first thing we want to do is ask ourselves, we already have one parameter, which is, if we talk about that, the total amount of energy added to the envelope plus the luminosity coming from the center of the star is equal to some base energy. If that's greater than the Eddington limit, then you can at least start initiating a flow. So key requirement, of course, is that gamma naught, which is the ratio of L naught over L Eddington, be greater than 1. But it turns out, if you think about it, that's hardly a sufficient condition. A lot of times people will say, well, if the star goes above the Eddington limit, it just falls apart. Well, it can't happen, right? Because there's only a finite amount of energy coming out of the star. And therefore, you have to ask yourself, What layer can you actually add energy, make this hard above the Eddington limit, and actually drive a flow that can be lifted off the surface up from that radius? So there's another condition, which is that, and this is a more fundamental one, is that this luminosity has to be bigger than the mass loss rate times the gravitational potential energy per unit mass. Okay? And if this isn't true, then you won't be able to sustain a steady state wind. So this is like an energy requirement. This is a momentum requirement. So one way we can talk about this is talk about what is the maximum mass loss rate we can have. Well, that would just be L naught divided by Gm over R. Well, let's try to figure out what the value of that is. It turns out that if you evaluate that, that's equal to about 0.3 solar masses per year for luminosity that's 10 to the 6 solar luminosities, and mass over radius that's relative to the solar mass over radius. Most stars near the main sequence, even massive stars, this is not too much different than one.
Can I ask a question?
Yep.
What I'm wondering is, so we have situations where stars produce a lot of energy at a given point of in time. And what comes to mind with me is, for example, the shell flashes on the AGB. Now, what happens there is that the luminosities can go up to 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 solar luminosities, and still nothing happens. So, I mean, the star makes a little expands a little bit, and that's it.
Well, I have never tried to model the flash, the helium flash, but I would have to say that somewhere that energy is going to have to find its way out of the envelope after the envelope is, the envelope, if it's deposited deep, can be like a cushion. Like, you know, if you explode, you know, when I was once in Israel, we went to this cave, and we viewed these stalactites and stuff. And we came out of the cave, and there's this little icon of a grenade. And I asked my friend Nir Shaviv, what is that? He says, well, that's a place that if anybody finds a bomb, they throw it down into this hole, and it explodes down inside the Earth and doesn't do any damage to anything. So in some ways, the envelope of a star is like a cushion that kind of keeps the whole thing from, you know, blowing up off the surface. And so, yes, it's indeed, I think you can have that situation. But I have never studied what happens to helium flashes, but somewhere that energy has to come out. And if it comes out, maybe it comes out so slowly in low-mass stars that it never reaches the Eddington limit, and so you don't ever lose much mass.
Well, as I said, locally, it's 10 to the 9 must be, you know, Eddington factors of 1,000 or more.
Sure, but the point is that it's got this big cushion about it, right?
So is there another condition that required?
Well, that's a good point for discussion.
Energy condition, isn't it? The total energy, isn't it?
He's saying that, yeah, so maybe what happens is the envelope expands and sort of absorbs this, and then it comes out over such a long time scale that whatever energy you've deposited is never above the Eddington limit, and then you never see any mass loss.
But there's no energy condition right now.
This is basically, I'm saying I'm adding energy to some relatively near surface layer, not right in the center, but maybe the core eruption, and we can get energy out through convection or something.
Yeah.
That's another way to get things to the surface. But the idea is that what we're going to study is the deposition of energy in a relatively shallow layer that's still optically thick. You know, tau is still greater than 1, but nonetheless is not so deep inside the star.
Also, Stan, you're talking about the continuous steady deposition of energy.
That's right.
This
we're not
rising
talking about
up to 10 to the 9 solar luminosities doesn't happen over a long period of time.
But I don't think that's a physical reason why this expansion and mass loss doesn't happen. Right? You need a better argument for why you don't get ejection, right?
Let's come back to that, because, you know,
so you need a physical condition for why the energy can't be transported out vectorically, right? Why it has to drive an outflow.
Right, but we'll come to that. That involves convection theory, which gets more complicated. Yeah.
So the luminosity is the luminosity from the star plus energy deposition.
Energy deposition per unit time.
What's depositing the energy?
Some kind of Deus Ex Machina, right? It's Jim Fuller's waves.
Okay.
It's binary. It could be from the outside. It could be from the inside, from waves. It could be from the outside, from two stars trying to merge or being a common envelope. You're just adding energy to some outer layer of the star. And we want to ask what would happen.
It could be a nova flash. Anything.
Yeah. So anyway, this is just the basic toy model. But the key point I want to make here is that the amount of mass, if you just have 10 to the 6 solar luminosities, you can, if you use all of the energy, you can get 3% of a solar mass per year, okay? Which is a big number compared to any kind of mass loss rate you heard about yesterday. The mass loss rates that are due to line driving are factors of 10 or 100 smaller than this at least, right? But if you now have Eta Carina, for example, in the 1840s, its luminosity got up to of order 30 million suns. If you multiply 30 times that, that's one solar mass per year. So the point is that you can drive a large amount of mass if you can just tap all of the energy. But you can't normally do that with line opacity because line opacity self-saturates and it only ends up being kind of a surface thing that doesn't use up very much of the energy at all. The luminosities of Wolf-Rayet stars that we observe are hardly different than what the energy that's coming from the interior. Very little energy is in the wind for most stars. But we're talking about a case now where we can actually push up against this energy limit, which I call the photon tiring limit, because the photons kind of get tired. They lose energy as they try to push on the gas and expand it. All right, so what we want to know is how close to this limit are we? We have one parameter, gamma naught. Let's define another parameter, which is little m, which is basically m dot divided by this m dot max. And that's just m dot times gm over l naught r. Okay? And that always has to be less than 1 if we're going to sustain a wind. So now we have two parameters, what I call the tiring parameter and the Eddington parameter. And we want to find out that if we have these two parameters, what comes out? What is the luminosity at infinity? What is the observed luminosity for a given M and L? And what is the kinetic energy? Comes out. How much energy comes out in this form, the potential energy, the gravitational? So how much comes out as kinetic energy? How much comes out as luminosity? And how much comes out as potential energy from gravity, which is this number. Okay? This is luminosity. All right, so how do we go about trying to answer this question? Well, we have to go to a momentum equation now. We have to talk about the equation of motion. Now, for steady state, the equation of motion is very simple. It's the effective acceleration is equal to the radiative force, which is was written yesterday by Yorick, can be written in just this form, minus the gravity. Okay? So now...
So no gas pressure.
Well, okay, so glad you asked the question. Gas pressure plays a role and allowing you to go from a hydrostatic layer to a layer that starts having an outflow. But gas pressure in stars, and that's the stars near the main sequence, are limited by the fact that the sound speed, which is of order tens of kilometers a second, is much, much less than the escape speed. So gas pressure plays no essential role in driving the wind. It just provides a way to get a boundary layer.
But
down.
You consider the place where you deposit energy. It doesn't have to be the same place.
Well, but even at these layers, even at temperatures of 100,000 Kelvin, the sound speed is still way below the escape speed. So gas pressure never plays a dynamical role in surface ejection of matter. Radiation pressure.
No, you switch to the surface and from the place where you deposit.
Well, the deposit. I'm saying in subsurface layers, okay? In these layers, the gas pressure still is dynamically unimportant compared to radiation pressure. Okay. You have to go very, very deep inside.
Where we deposit energy in the Comedon below, gas pressure definitely plays a role.
Well, it depends on your situation, I guess. We have to talk about that. In lower luminosity mergers, maybe that might be true. But in the context of massive stars, the point is, maybe because your binding energies, your envelopes are much more extended. But when you have a star whose mass over radius is comparable to the Sun, the escape speed is on the order of 600 kilometers per second. And the sound speed is on the order of 20 kilometers a second or 30 kilometers a second. The ratio of those two things is 1 over 30, and then the energy is 1 over 30 squared. There's less than 0.1% of the energy necessary to make mass be lost in the internal energy of gas as you need to escape. So a very common way to go is to say, this is for velocities greater than the sound, which is much, much less than the escape. So you're starting your wind at some velocity. You're starting your wind, this force has to go above gravity at that point. That defines the starting point.
But a little bit, it's like you put already in what you want to get out, right?
So no, not at all.
You don't consider the possibility that instead of ejecting mass at supersonic speed, the star will just slowly puff up.
No, we're not assuming that at all. We're going to get speeds here that are comparable to the escape speed. We're going to get speeds that are several times the escape speed. We're not trying to puff up the envelope. We're actually driving a wind.
That's what you want to do. The point is that you are talking about things which are close to the Eddington limit, and I think that is a bit of a confusion.
Well, it's not really close to the Eddington limit, it's defined to be above the Eddington limit.
Above the Eddington limit.
Because we did the simulations, I mean, you can deposit energy which will be above Eddington, and depending on, it really depends, you can inflate envelope or you can eject envelope, because this is what comes out of hydro.
So dropping a term really only makes sense if it simplifies the problem.
Yes, it simplifies the problem greatly, because now you just have a simple equation of motion that's that simple. Otherwise, we have to put in, if we put in the gas pressure, this becomes, this term on the left-hand side becomes V sound squared over V. And now that's no big deal, because this will become small in the supersonic part of the wind.
Maybe it doesn't become supersonic. How do you know?
Because if this force goes above gravity, then that's one of the solutions that you can find. That's what happens in line-driven winds.
This is why I got supersonic convection.
Okay, well, let's come back to this. This issue, right, I tell you, in the context of massive stars blowing off of like a star that's close to the Eddington limit, whose mass over radius is not too different than the Sun, gas pressure cannot play a very dynamic report role. Maybe in common envelope cases where the M over R is much, much smaller, and maybe it can. And in those stars also, the luminosity is not very large. So we can come back to this issue, but I think I want to get through.
Yeah, but then you go to a common envelope, the luminosity becomes 10 and 6.
Okay, well, okay, maybe it doesn't have any relevance to common envelope. I will defer to the experts and we'll talk about it some more. I want to get to the point where we can explain what kind of solutions you get from a super Eddington wind. In that case, it's easiest just if you drop this term, because all it does is provide a map onto the hydrostatic star. Okay, so now if we were to multiply this times 4 pi r squared rho, this equation, then we would be able to derive an equation like that Jorek was asserting yesterday about the relationship, the momentum of the wind and the momentum of the photons times the optical depth. So on the right-hand side, you would get something that was a proportional of the optical depth. But I'm not going to do that, because all I'm really interested in this case is looking at what this equation looks like in a general form. So what I'm going to do is rewrite this equation as just being using the gamma minus 1 times gravity. So now we can very easily, if we assume gamma as a constant just for simplicity, we can easily see that this will lead to a terminal speed which is just gamma minus 1 times gm over r. If we integrate this from some r, from some v equal to close to 0 to v infinity, and we integrate this from some r to infinity, then we'll get something like that. And this, of course, is just an escape speed squared over 2. So we already have, in this context, we cancel out the 2s, we already have this very simple relationship between the escape speed and the flow speed of the wind. It just depends on how big gamma is.
So your lower limit of your integral goes to v equals 0?
Well, to the sound speed, which is very close to 0. Okay? I mean, we could do it, and we could subtract off v sound squared over 2, but that's much, much less than either one of these speeds in the context that I'm talking about. Okay? All right, so the point is, how fast can a wind go? It just depends on how far above the Eddington limit you are. Okay? If you exceed the Eddington limit by, if this number is 10, then you've got 10 minus 1 is 9. There's 9 times more energy in the wind than there is in potential energy. That is to say, the flow speed of the wind will be 3 times the escape speed. If we were to just all of a sudden in this room make gamma equal to 2, we would all fly away from the Earth, and we would end up at terminal speed of the escape speed of the Earth. Yeah, Yanfei.
So in this integral, you have given the luminosity at a constant, right?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that.
But I mean, no. I mean the point that if you deposit energy in a very thick layers.
Yeah, well, I'm saying we're going to make it basically deposit energy in a nano layer, and after that, it's going to stay constant. Okay, but I'm not putting in terms that I'm going to get to the point that I'm using a simple example right now. I'll get to the energy conservation in a second.
Okay.
So I'm just using it as an illustration. In other words, this, what Yanfei is alluding to, I think, is that this really applies in the limit where we don't have any energy being expended in the wind, where this tiring number is 0, or essentially 0. It's much, much less than 1. That is to say, we don't have to correct for how much energy is reduced as the luminosity goes up. Right? And that's the key. We don't, at this point, we're just assuming that the wind has no, doesn't break a sweat. It just basically blows things away.
I mean more than that.
Okay.
Well, I think for the radiation, I think now you know for the radiation acceleration, that term you try to write, you really only care about the diffusive flux, right?
Yeah. I'm getting there.
Okay.
These guys don't know anything about that stuff, so we have to take baby steps. Okay. I'll get there.
Okay.
Please be patient. Okay. So as Andre is making 2 points. The first one, I think, is that the luminosity does not stay constant, that the luminosity is a function of radius. Because whatever you put in at the base, minus whatever energy you lose as you expand outward. Okay? This I call, now, I'm going to get there, Anfei. There's going to be another term here, okay? Be patient, okay? But this is the what I call photon tiring, or energy reduction due to the fact that it's doing work to lift the gas out of the potential, that's this term, plus giving it kinetic energy. Okay? So that's a really important equation. It's one that I first considered in a conference paper from Kona in 1997. And turns out that if you now use a simplifying approach where basically you define a parameter W as the energy of the wind compared to the escape energy, and you define a new coordinate, x minus r divided by r, big R by little r, this is proportional to the potential energy, then you can rewrite this equation of motion in a nice form, which is dw dx is equal to gamma of x minus 1. But gamma of x is just gamma naught 1 minus mw plus x. And then this is gravity. You've scaled out gravity by dividing by the escape speed. So This is gravity here. Okay? And so now you have this equation here. But it turns out that equation can be integrated analytically. And what you get is that W plus X times this little m is equal to e to the, 1 minus e to the minus m gamma naught times X. That's an analytic solution that includes photon tiring. Okay? So now, what does that look like? If we plot, x equal to 1 from 0, this is r, r equal to r, and this is r going to infinity. The nice thing about this coordinate x is it maps from 0, r to infinity onto 0 to 1. Another nice thing about that. And now we plot W on this coordinate, which is just V squared over V escape squared. Then the solutions look like this. Gamma minus 1 would be the solution that you get when M is equal to 0. That's just recovering what we just learned already from this integral. But if you start making m bigger, the solutions start to fall below. Say this might be m equal to 0.3 or something. And if you get to a maximum m for a given gamma, the flow will actually stagnate and stop. So this is some maximum m that depends on gamma. M max, which is a function of gamma. For gamma very, very large, it's 1.
Is there also a contribution from the change of the internal energy of the gas?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the internal energy of the gas or the internal energy of the radiation? The gas, it, again, is, if you look at the numbers, it's just never important dynamically in this model. The temperature is just not high enough for gas pressure to be important. For the kind of models that
so
I'm talking
about. In principle, there is a contribution to just...
It's just small. It's small. You can put it in.
What about the radiation?
But we'll come to the radiation now, next. That's the next thing we have to talk about. Because it turns out that in addition to this, what Yonfei was basically saying, is that this comes about from my experience of working in mostly optically thick, thin winds. You never have to worry about the energy balance, and you never have to worry about the fact that if you're in a very optically thick medium, there now develops a radiation pressure. That is to say, for tau much, much bigger than 1, let's just do it down here, for tau much, much bigger than 1, P rad is of order, C times P rad is of order tau times the flux. And so there turns out to be an important term here, which is 4 p rad times velocity. The 4 p rad, that is the enthalpy of radiation. Deep inside of a star, p rad is 1/3 of e rad. So this is e rad plus p rad. And that turns out in a deep inside star, where p rad is 1/3 of e rad, turns out to be 4. So this is the enthalpy that we're talking about. And this is like a drag term. And everything that I did up until now, up until this time I came here, I had ignored that term. Okay? So now, what do we do? Well, it turns out we can still pretty much use the same equation of motion if we could incorporate this P rad term into the L if we just add another term to this equation.
Stan, can I ask you just something?
Yeah.
So the enthalpy term, usually it helps if you speak about gas pressure.
We'll come to it. It's a drag term on the direct driving, but then it stores energy, which then can be reused to keep maintain the outflow. We'll come to that. Okay? This is something that Ellie and I puzzled over at first, but now we understand thanks to the solutions that Rich was able to derive. So the bottom line is that you have to add an enthalpy, this 4P rad V, H rad is just equal to 4P rad divided by density. That can also be written as m dot over 4 pi r squared h rad is equal to 4 p rad times v. So basically, this 4 p rad times v that's here can be put in, remember the m dot's going to get divided by 4 pi r squared, can be put into inside of this bracket as an enthalpy term. Okay? And so for the equation of motion, the enthalpy term is like a drag term. Okay? So now, how do we solve this? Because now we have a coupled problem. We have a momentum equation, V dV dr is equal to kappa L of r over 4 pi r squared c, I'm just rewriting it again, minus gm over r squared. And this term has the p rad drag, includes p rad. We have to know what p rad is. So we have to use the radiative diffusion equation, dp rad over dr minus 1 is equal to kappa rho l of r divided by 4 pi r squared. We have to solve both of these equations. They're coupled. Okay? Now, what did we do in the past? Well, it's easy. What I did is I just ignored that, and I got this solution. What did Elliot do in his 2015 paper? Elliot said, well, if we're talking about a very, very optically thick region, this here is of order d tau dr. And so if it's very optically thick, or as Elliot put it in the email exchange with me, imagine that kappa rho, kappa is going to a very large number. Then it must be true that to keep dp rad dr at finite, that L rad, that L of r has to get very small. So what Elliot basically did is he set this equal to zero. And then he says, okay, if I set it equal to zero, now I have that, all I have is this is like a Bernoulli term, which is just an algebraic equation, because H rad can be written as H rad is proportional to rho to the gamma minus 1, which for a four-thirds polytrope is one-third. And that's just proportional to 1 over v, r squared, to the 1/3. And so this equation can be algebraically solved and get a solution for the velocity of the flow. Okay, and that...
I love where you introduce the polytropic equation.
Okay, so this is radiation, which behaves like a polytropic... radiation behaves like a polytropic rho to the 4/3, right? And so when you divide by density 1 here, that's gamma to the minus 1. 4/3 minus 1 is 1/3. And so it's a polytropic equation. This is really just like A rad's, V sound rad squared. This is like an alternative sound speed.
So why L of R is not 0?
Why is L of R not zero?
Why is it zero?
Because Elliot argued in his paper that for very, very optically thick flows, this number becomes very large. And to keep P rad from blowing up, you need to make L of R very small. And so, you know, this is an approximation he made in his paper. To be honest with you, when I saw it, I said, how in the hell can you do that? And we went back and had a big discussion back and forth. But this is not, he's not the only one that's done this. It's very traditional for people who have studied super Eddington problems. There are several other papers where people use this approximation that it's just a polytropic flow. It's not unique to what Elliot did, but that's what he did.
I'm not capable of polytropic flow. I just don't understand where air water becomes here.
All I can say to you is that if you take kappa and the limit of kappa going to infinity, Elliot argued that the only way that P rad can stay, P rad can stay finite, is if L gets very small.
I think physically the argument is that you've converted all of the luminosity into a combination of radiative enthalpy, potential energy, and kinetic energy.
That's right.
Very quickly above the energy injection radius. So that you've already converted all of the radiant luminosity into other forms of energy.
So basically what Elliot is saying... What Elliot is saying is that... Elliot's saying that he's assuming that the delta E dot goes directly into enthalpy without ever bypassing the luminosity. Just basically short circuits it. It goes directly into enthalpy. But what we're going to show is that it actually goes into luminosity, and then it goes into enthalpy through the drag term. But he made the approximation that it goes directly into enthalpy, and then he solved the enthalpy equation.
So
if you set this equal to zero, then you need to have H rad. When at the base, this becomes zero. This becomes
zero.
Yeah, this becomes zero, and then M rad has to be bigger than gravity.
You drive entropy to the equation. Then you have to do a convention. You create a huge entropy bulb. Yeah, I mean, this is what we do in common envelope in some sense.
Well, I mean, this is what you do whenever you say, I'm gonna
bypass the momentum
track. And so it's just a pressure and a radiation pressure.
I'm gonna bypass the momentum equation. That's what basically you're doing. And so, so what we're saying is that's interesting. We both were doing it from two different points of view. I was doing it from the outside in point of view, where it's a wind, and I ignored the drag. Elliot says, this enthalpy is the dominant term, and that basically you have to then include that term in the basically that term becomes the dominant term that drives your outflow.
And what we're freaking out at this moment why the gas pressure is still excluded.
Well, so it's not gas, it's radiation pressure that's still dominated. It's not,
we could have included,
it's 18 to the fourth.
If we put H gas here, it would be much smaller than
you put in NKT, it's still way smaller. It's
way smaller.
It's H rad. It's 18 to the fourth that's dominating.
So we could have put it in, but I'm trying to do this on a blackboard. I can't put in every detail. It can be put in, but you can show it's very small. In the kind of circumstances that I'm talking about. Now, I'm not saying a convolute envelope, it might not be important. It could be.
Well, but I mean, I tell you right away, it's a lot of the hydro stuff, when you assume radiation is trapped, you have this gas pressure that includes this radiation term, so you think of them as the same. That's the issue.
But it's dominated. But for any high temperature, it's dominated by radiation.
Radiation pressure dominates.
So the gas pressure is never doing very much in this context, unless you get to a point where the sound speed becomes comparable to your escape speed. It's just never important dynamically. Okay, so what does that lead? If we solve this equation now, what kind of solutions do we get? Well, we get solutions now. Let's do this now on the log W, and then we'll have minus 4 log of X. The reason for the log is that in Elliott's model, the velocity is not guaranteed to go to a small value at the heating radius. Matter of fact, in many circumstances, it's actually supersonic in any context. It's supersonic in terms of the radiative sound speed. So you have to start the wind at a already supersonic speed at your heating radius. That just isn't physical. If you want to have a hydrostatic region go on to a supersonic flow, you have to start at a low velocity. So when you include the full equations, that is possible. That has actually happened. You start at a value that's very low, and then it goes up to, let's say this is log W over 1 minus gamma. And it goes up to some value. It's just like in the other solution. No, it's set by the gamma minus, gamma minus 1. And but then what happens is that instead of the flow making these kinds of overshoots and then slowing down, the flow starts to accelerate, but then it hits a plateau, and then it finally accelerates to whatever terminal speed it's going to get. And what's happening in this region is that the radiation force that's driving the flow is accelerating it. But meanwhile, the drag term starts to suck away flux, and it stores it in the enthalpy. So you get kind of a plateau region, and then that enthalpy allows you to continue the flow to whatever value you get. And so you get, for different, this is like m equal to 0.5 or something. But if you go to a large enough m, this terminal speed goes to zero. W infinity goes to zero if for m equal to m max, which turns out to be 1 over 1 minus gamma naught.
So is the acceleration happening in an optically thick regime, or is it
fully optically thick?
So it's way optically thick where it's...
Yeah. Well, I mean, it breaks down in the very outer parts. Because,
yeah,
you know,
but if the acceleration's already happened, I don't care what happens at the other parts.
So basically, the two boundary conditions you have in this is that W goes to 0 at x equals to 0, but P rad, or V goes to 0, if you will, P rad goes to 0 at, let's put it this way, at R equal to R, at R going to infinity. So you have to solve this coupled system from both sides, and it's very stiff, and Rich was really doing a tour de force work last week solving that system using various tricks. Anyway, this turns out to be the major result, is that you get a slow velocity at the base, just like you need to, and then you get the storage of energy in the enthalpy, but there's being a conversion of the radiative flux, the radiative luminosity, into kinetic energy, and then also into enthalpy, hrad. And this hrad plateau is a storage of enthalpy, which then allows the final acceleration of the wind.
What triggers the release of the energy from the enthalpy into acceleration again?
It's just basically this solution. I mean, this is basically the domain where the solution works. It's just the trade-off between the enthalpy and doing work on these other terms.
It may be useful to know, for example, after the plateau, when the acceleration happens again, do you know what are the optimal depths?
Yeah, it's still very high.
No, I don't want to know the value. Like, do you know?
Well, I don't know. It depends on the specific circumstance. So,
but I guess that actually what happened at that regime that if your open depth drops to the value roughly like the C over V, then you basically your entropy become the diffusive flux, and then you release that to accelerate the gas. That's my guess.
But you can look at it that way. You can look at it from the point of view of the Bernoulli equation as well. Well, I mean, this solution is very much similar to what Elliott finds in his Bernoulli solutions. It's just that his model would go across here and have a very high flow speed at the base. Okay, so there's two key results that come out of this. One is that value of W at infinity, which is just V infinity, just scales like gamma naught over 1 plus M gamma naught minus 1. That's just equal to V infinity squared over V escape squared. So that's our desired solution for how is the energy partitioned. You can see that as M goes to zero, this just becomes gamma naught minus 1. But as M goes to this value, M max, then V infinity squared over V escape squared goes to gamma minus 1. V infinity goes to 0. So that's the maximum you can actually drive and get a finite speed at infinity.
So, before you go on, I just want to make sure I understand your top plot. The dashed line is if I did Elliott's assumption.
Yep.
And then the curved line is if actually I solve those equations.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And this is if you ignore photon target altogether. Perfect. And so there's a series of these solutions, and you know, but I don't want to draw them all. Okay, the other thing that's interesting is that the value of the luminosity at infinity over the base luminosity scales as 1 over 1 m gamma naught. Now, what's interesting about that, of course, is if m is equal to 0, you just get all the luminosity out. Nothing is lost in the wind. Nothing has been used by the wind. But if you set m equal to m max, and you find that L infinity equals L Eddington. In other words, it doesn't go to 0. It goes to the Eddington value. And that is something that is I learned from Philippe, that it actually occurs in other solutions like accretion disks. You always get at least the Eddington
photon trapping.
And it's also something that was also concluded in Elliott's paper. Okay, so these are our two big scaling laws. So that's the solution of reconciling Elliott's approach and my approach now with the unified theory. Everything seems to work really well. We now have steady state solutions for mass loss near the Eddington limit. Now, the problem with this is that these two things are parameters. They're not solutions. We haven't derived a mass loss rate. We've essentially assumed a mass loss rate. And we've studied what would be the nature, under what conditions can we get a steady solution. But unlike in CAK theory, where you can actually derive a mass loss rate given the luminosity of the star, the opacity, and so forth, here, the mass loss rate depends on where you put the energy deposition. And if you put the energy deposition too deep, then it's likely that whatever flow you try to initiate will exceed this m equal to 1 limit, or this m equal to minus gamma limit. And then what happens is that you try to initiate an outflow, which then eventually doesn't have enough energy to be maintained and stagnates. And so the kind of thing you can expect, if m is greater than 1, or let's put it this way, m max, which is 1 minus 1 over gamma, is that the flow will go up and it'll stagnate and come back down. Here you're putting in your luminosity at the bottom. And the problem is that the density is too high that m dot, that m becomes bigger than m max. This is very reminiscent of the kind of things that Yan Fei showed for his iron bump simulations, where material goes up and comes back down and is a very, very... And so what you need to do here is 3D radiation hydro to find out what happens. But a conjecture...
The condition implies that you chose a mass loss rate which is inappropriate for the Eddington.
Well, it implies that you've added this energy and it's such a deep layer. Sorry? Yeah, say, go ahead.
I have a question.
Hey.
The if condition you wrote there means that you have chosen a mass loss rate which is inappropriate to the Eddington factor which you assume.
It's such a mass loss rate that you can't get a steady state wind to infinity.
But this depends on the Eddington factor?
It does depend on the Eddington factor through this maximum condition. If you want to, we can just drop this. What happens if m dot is greater than 1? That's clearly impossible. It's impossible to drive a wind with a mass loss rate that's greater than the energy that you have available to make it to infinity.
Which is specified by your Eddington factor.
It doesn't. That number, this number here, is independent of the Eddington parameter. This is just luminosity gm over r. But in practice, what we've shown is that for a modest Eddington factor, you can't even reach the 1 limit. Okay, you can't even reach the 1 limit for a modest Eddington factor. So this is really the functional limit. But the point is that because there's nothing regulating super Eddington continuum driven mass loss, if you start too deep, then the wind will have too big a mass flux. and it won't be able to be sustained.
But where does this depth enter in all the effects?
It enters into where you decide to put this energy into the prop.
Yeah, but which quantity, which is on the blackboard, does this enter?
It's this radius, right there. What is the density at that radius? What is the density of the solar envelope at that radius? That's where you start your outflow. And that determines your mass loss rate. So if you try to start it too deep, you exceed this limit. There's nothing. The point here is that line-driven mass loss never goes too deep because it self-saturates by the lines becoming self-saturated. But because the continuum driving, radiation force is still the same no matter how deep you go. The radiation force that you have is always kappa F over C. Doesn't go down because the density is high.
But it's a limitation because he only considers the case when the radiation pressure is, so the gas pressure can be neglected, right?
That's not the case.
Yeah, I just wanted to
know. So
what radius is there actually? Is that actually, can you just move a little bit? So is that R0 or?
R is the radius at which you add your energy. Right. It's the radius, it's some narrow band where you add energy. All I'm saying is if you add that energy too deep, or if you put that energy too deep and you put it into radiation, one of the things that can happen is that you put that energy in and it just causes convection for a while. But convection can't carry energy to infinity. So at some point when convection becomes inefficient, you have to now carry the energy with radiation.
So what is M in that equation?
What is M? M is the ratio of the mass.
One line up. Yes.
M is the mass of the star.
Okay, and R?
Is the radius at the envelope where you add the energy.
So if you R would go down, what potential energy are you counting? Should your M go down as well? Or?
It's not the fact that R goes down that makes the energy deeper. It's the fact that the density is dropping very rapidly with radius.
So I don't see that in the equation.
Well, I don't put it. It's not part of it. There is some density from the hydrostatic solution at that radius. It's just that the star has a density at a given radius. You add energy to that.
I understand your point, but I don't see it in the math.
No, I didn't put it in because I'm just assuming that the assumption is that we're looking for a steady state solution. The requirement is that the density of that radius is such that the mass loss rate is below this maximum. When you overcome gravity at a given radius, the mass loss rate goes back to this issue of the sonic point. Okay? The mass loss rate where gamma equals one in this model. The mass loss rate will just be equal to 4 pi rho at that radius times the sound speed times that radius squared. So ultimately, it depends on the sound speed.
I understand that argument, but it's like an implicit condition, which is never really...
Exactly, because when we started out, all we were doing is looking for a model where the that would be able to make it to infinity. So we're trying to outline under what circumstances could we have a steady state Cooper-Eddington rim. Two conditions are that the gamma be above 1 everywhere, and that the mass loss rate be below this maximum. What makes the mass loss rate, what fixes the mass loss rate, is whatever the density is of the envelope at that radius. So now if the problem is if we put this heating too deep, then the mass that the radiation tries to drive will basically not be able to be sustained.
Yeah, well, it would be interesting perhaps to work out a solution, combine these two conditions and see what it means for real stars, you know, how deep you have to put your energy in order to do what you're saying.
This is...
So maybe a way to think about it is we've just solved for velocities here, but the mass loss rate... There's a velocity times the density. So that's where the density will factor in. Because once we have a velocity, then we can solve for mass loss rate, and that enters into this cram very well. Well,
there's still a consistency check which may be necessary. So if your answer would be that you can only put your energy at a depth that maybe you aren't optically thick, you know, then this all becomes inconsistent, for example.
Yes.
No, it's not. It doesn't have to be. Okay, it doesn't have to be optically thin. It just doesn't have to be so optically thick. It comes back to the equations that we didn't write down about finding out how momentum is related to optical depth. In other words, another equation that we could have derived, but I didn't, left off because of time, is that m dot times v infinity squared over 2 plus gm over r. That divided by the luminosity can actually be written as tau times v infinity over 2c. But that number always has to be less than 1. The total amount of energy in the wind can never exceed the luminosity that you give it. And this condition on optical depth, because v infinity is typically much smaller than c, tau can be much bigger than 1 and still approach this limit. So we can go into regions of very optically thick flow, which is what we're modeling here, that are nonetheless able to reach.
We need to go to very optically thick regions. Otherwise, this is not valid. You need to go to.
Yes. Well,
I'm asking, are you? You know, is that consistent with real stars? That's my question.
Yes. The optical depths in these models can be computed, and it's proportional to this factor, m dot, m times gamma.
I think I should wrap up this part.
Okay. So let me just finish the, because we had a lot of questions, I wasn't able to get to the full thing. But basically what I believe will happen in this case is that because you have supersonic upflows, you'll generate supersonic turbulence, like I said over here, and that will become very, we'll have a lot of shocks, and shocks compress material and make a lot of density homogeneities. And just as we saw in Jan Fay's simulations for the iron bump, what that will lead is to porosity. And this porosity, once it's evaluated, can actually reduce the coupling of the radiation with the gas and allow, it basically gives you, see, part of the problem here is that in line opacity, or line force. Force is proportional to velocity gradient to the alpha over density. And it's this density that regulates the mass loss rate to be the CAK mass loss rate. And it's much, much less than this maximum mass loss rate that we have. But when you have continuum driving, there's no such regulator. And so if you try to start the wind too deep, you'll get too much mass loss. It won't be regulated. But if we now allow for there to be porosity, it turns out that in the case of porosity, if you have a porosity, the radiated force in porosity depends on some effective opacity, which is reduced according to some power of the density, like the square root of the density. And I've actually developed models of porosity based on my simulations of line to shadow instability, which gives us an analytic scaling for that. And the big question is, how is that analytic scaling, is that a general scaling that we can apply in this problem? But the most important thing is that the only way we're going to get at knowing what this porosity is and how much the radiation force is reduced is if we do 3dB radiation hydro. So, you know, I've talked a lot about Jan Fay's stuff. Chris Fryer has also been telling me about codes that he have in Los Alamos that potentially could solve this problem. But in my way of thinking is that what will happen is that you'll end up getting a very turbulent medium. We'll have something like supersonic, super Eddington convection, which will eventually give way to a very porous medium, which then allows there to be a quasi-steady outflow. That's kind of the scenario that we're building towards. The essential point that I want to make here is that, continuum driving, super Eddington driving, does not have a natural regulator. And therefore, we can derive solutions like this. We make the restrictive assumption that we add the energy to a layer that's low enough density that the mass loss that's established, that's initiated, is below this energy limit. But generally speaking, that's not going to be the case. And then what we'll end up with is something that is very strongly radiation hydrodynamic turbulence. And that, for that, we need to do 3D radiation hydrodynamics. Okay, thanks. Sure.
I think that this mostly may apply best is the Novi, as you said, Jim, because the Novi, in the case of Novi, we know observationally we get something like a steady state wind, and we have the energy deposition from the Nova flash. And so what I would do is to see how far the Nova people have developed all this, because there's quite
a lot. I know that near Shaviv, who I've established, this, a lot of these ideas go back to stuff that I've done with NIR. There's a 2000 paper that NIR and I have that basically developed a model like this without the...
You're talking about Novi.
I understand. I'm saying NIR himself has also applied the similar models to Novi.
Yeah, but there's a big community there. Which, you know, is...
But I personally don't think that this is irrelevant to the massive stars that we're talking about. I think that has a lot of potential for helping us understand LBD constraints.
Nova case, they have a lot of observational constraints as well. You know, so
and super soft, so have these winds too.
I'm sorry?
Super soft sources have these winds too.
Perhaps as well.
Well, Nova and super soft equipment.
So also, I just want to say I'll talk about some of this probably next week, it sounds like. Is the kind of plan, and I'm just doing 1D hydro runs of all this, where I put in an energy, which I try to calculate self-consistently, and I definitely get both kinds of solutions. I get solutions where you have the super Eddington steady state wind, and then I also see solutions where the energy input is not enough to drive all that mass off, and the flow goes up and it stagnates. So I think both situations can be realized in nature. But it depends where you put the energy.
I'm not sure if I can.
If you put it in a region that's too dense, you don't have enough energy to lift everything off.
But anyway, the OS 10.10 looks a little different than 10.9. So how do I see anything?
Oh, I just let it off for you, sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, plug it in.
I shouldn't have to do that. I should already be sending it. It's just which button. Do we have a time?
Oh, so I want to mention one other thing. So I talked to Chris and Joyce in order to talk a little bit more about the details of how we might do the simulations of this, or also how we derive this porosity scaling. We're going to have a discussion maybe tomorrow afternoon. I guess, is there something else that's scheduled?
Yeah.
2 o'clock. So maybe we could do ours at like 3:30. If anybody wants to join that, let us know.
So you said 3 o'clock on Thursday, right?
3:30. 3:30. After cookies. It's important.
I can use this. Well, I've been enjoying being here and listening to all these discussions and learning a lot. So I have a lot of questions, mostly for people here in this talk. I'm going to talk about pulsations and massive stars, and in particular some calculations we've been doing at Los Alamos from 1993 to the present. I haven't worked in this area full time. I've mostly been doing astroseismology and helioseismology, but we like to try our codes out on just about any kind of pulsating variable, so we decided to try them out on some massive stars in the mid-90s and late 90s. And all of the work we've done for this 20 years, I finally put it into
a review article that's in Astronomical Review, and then I did a better layout in LaTeX. And you can look at all of this work at this preprint from 2014 that Catherine Lovkin also helped me with. And Catherine also has a relatively new paper in Monthly Notices from 2014 as well. So doing luminous blue variables, which is what we wanted to try to start doing, was a little bit too difficult for the first try. So I went back and we tried looking at stars that were a little bit less massive to see what our pulsation code said about those. So this is the Beta Cephei instability region, and this is the SPB instability region on the main sequence. And this is the HR diagram from Pamyatnik of 2002 that delineated these instability regions according to linear pulsation theory. So what we did is evolved a model over here to about the edge of the instability region. So it's kind of finishing hydrogen burning and on its way to across the HR diagram. And I was looking at where the pulsation driving is, and you can see here the iron bump in the opacity. And this is for several different helium abundances. So just that changes the stellar structure and can affect the opacity in the envelope. And this is the work per zone. And if you integrate the work through the star, if it's positive, this mode will be driven. And if it's negative, it'll be damped. So here you see the driving in the iron region and some gradative damping here and here. And then it's going back up again toward the surface, but there's not much mass there. So I did a huge grid of models with a 1D hydrodynamic pulsation code with a time-dependent convection treatment. And the code is called DynStar, and it was written by Dale Ostley in the late 1980s. And we had it at Los Alamos because Dale was a student there. So we've been working with it since then. So this is only looking at radial pulsations. And we would kick these models off with an initial velocity of 5 or so kilometers per second, and then see if that mode grew or damped. We'd initiate it in a radial fundamental or a first overtone, some kind of a radial pulsation mode, whichever one looked like it would grow the fastest. And so here's a particular model. It's one of the first ones we did where it grew, but then it kind of settled down. And now the amplitude over time looks like it's still growing. So these have a period of about one day. And I have many of these pictures where we've changed the temperature here, going to a little bit higher temperature, a little bit farther into the Beta Cephei instability strip. This model is growing, the pulsations are growing really quickly. Here, with a lower temperature, they look like they're starting to damp out. So if I ran this further, maybe the amplitude would go to practically nothing. Here, with a even higher effective temperature, they're growing really fast.
Joyce?
Yes?
Does the growth rate match linear stability calculations?
The initial one does, yeah. But then when you go nonlinear, no, then they saturate somehow. Yeah. So I'm just showing you just random pictures from this parameter study. So you can see sometimes they damp down from the 5 kilometers per second. And usually with lower metallicity, they damp down, and higher helium, they damp down. So those are the two trends we found. So there's a whole bunch of these. I'm just going to go on. So I wasn't the only one.
Saturate nonlinearly?
Yeah. They reach a limiting amplitude in the hydro calculation.
Okay.
But I haven't run these long enough to really get the limiting amplitude, I would say. I probably have to run them for thousands of cycles. And I probably haven't run them that long. I'm just trying to look at what happens. Are they going to die out or this one looks like it might, you know, eventually die out. It's going down still, but we'll see.
What explains the difference between the two trends?
The difference between going up, it's different abundances and temperature in the photosphere, the effective temperature. So I varied those things around that initial evolution point.
So what you weren't showing an increase in temperature on the two trends is different?
I'm showing you a different model with a different temperature. Right. So I'm just trying to see, are these models unstable to radial nonlinear pulsations in a hydrodynamic code? And I'm finding that some of them are. So I was wondering if we ever see these in reality. And we've gone to looking at beta Cephei variables, which are non-linear, non-radial pulsating P modes, usually low amplitude. But why don't we see any high amplitude pulsating stars right at the end of the main sequence? And I wasn't the only one asking this question at the time. This is a paper by Dorfey and Gauchi that was suggesting that these kinds of stars be looked for, and they also had a non-linear code showing pulsations in their calculations around 2002.
Can you rephrase the question again? Because we see pulsating stars in the main sequence, so
Do we see large amplitude radial pulsators on the main sequence?
So how large are the amplitudes in your model?
20, 30, 40, let me see if I can get back here. This one is 50 kilometers a second.
EW vol?
There are some.
There are some.
Okay.
Also,
okay, so you're answering my question. That's right.
It's worth mentioning that your model is after the main sequence. It's not a main sequence star.
It's right at the end.
No, it's way beyond that. You go back to your HR diagram.
It's a little beyond. Okay.
No, it's way beyond it. The dotted line is the end of the main sequence.
Okay. So this is like a hydrogen shell burning then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Now, all these pulsating stars which are observed, what are the velocity amplitudes there?
They're pretty small, right?
Some stars have, like BW Val is 150, but some stars, only have 10. You know, there's a range. BW Val is a particularly unusual object. So 50 is kind of on the unusual side. That's kind of high.
That's kind of high.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the hydro simulations certainly generally seem to show higher amplitudes than observations, but there are a couple of exceptional observational cases.
Okay.
Is it fair to say that you observe fewer than you would expect based on a linear analysis of instability?
I don't know.
You don't know because you can't tell from the linear.
Yeah.
In linear, you don't know what the amplitudes are.
Yeah, you don't know what the amplitude should be.
But in terms of stars that we're observing up in that region.
We do see stars that appear not to pulsate inside the instability strip.
That's the other problem, right? There's some that are in the instability strip that don't pulsate. Okay. So, yeah. So I just found this, an interesting question, and whether we should go out and look for these stars, or maybe we're missing some physics. Maybe the mode energy that I'm showing all in radial modes is going into all the non-radial modes, and this code is only following the radial modes. And maybe there's some damping mechanisms we don't have. Yes?
Does your code include mass loss?
Yeah, I haven't included mass loss. No. And these are low, this is low velocity compared to the critical here. So I haven't included rotation either.
The mass loss could drag out energy
from the pulsation, sure. Yeah, that's very true. Yes. So, but this is a 20 solar mass star, so it's not one that has a lot of mass loss, I would think. That was lower than the 30. That was kind of a limit that was shown a couple days ago. So, okay. So these are the ones that are close to the, not on the main sequence, but close to the main sequence. So I wanted to look at some stars that are a little further from the main sequence. And so this is the Humphreys-Davidson 1994 paper showing the Humphreys-Davidson limit here. And as far as I know, we still don't see a lot of stars up here. Is that right or is that not right? Yes, we don't see a lot of stars up there. And these are the typical Esterhazy variables, and they seem to be kind of in a strip here below the Humphreys-Davidson limit. Stars down below this actually are visible. There's a lot of cool hypergiants, red stars over here to the right, but above this we don't see those. So it seems like stars that are revolving across here don't actually make it over to this region of the HR diagram if they're very massive. And is this because of these Esterhazy instabilities? And then we have the really large giant eruptors, Eta Carinae, P Cygni, that maybe are in another class on their own. So this is going back a lot of years, probably the Kona meeting in 1997 also, where Art Cox and a few other of my colleagues and I were trying to look at the LBV stars. So we evolved some models across with mass loss. So this model was 50 solar masses, and it was 31 by the time we decided to, where we examined this model in this radial pulsation code. And this is an 80 solar mass one that was evolved out to there. So we tried to put them around where the LBV stars are. And when we did some tests with different helium abundances in the envelope, different metallicities, and we found that in general, if you have very high helium abundances in the envelope, like maybe the whole envelope had been stripped off by mass loss and mixing had brought helium to the surface, so this one has helium abundance of 0.58, that we would get pulsations. They would be kind of ragged. They wouldn't be nice, the sinusoidal ones like the B-type stars, because there's probably lots of stuff going on in the different zones. If I ran this further, I'm not going to show those pictures today. They would just kind of go up and down with maybe some multi-mode pulsations, very non-adiabatic behavior because it's very high radiation pressure. But they would go on. They wouldn't outburst. They wouldn't be showing crazy behavior. But if we try to lower the helium abundances in the envelope, or in other cases, increase the metallicity, one or the other, we would start the model off, and it would try to start pulsating, but something would be going on in the inner envelope that would all of a sudden cause the photosphere. This is the photospheric radial velocity to accelerate a lot. This is 150 kilometers a second down here. And then this photospheric layer would try to recover, but some of the very outermost optically thin zones beyond the photosphere would start to leave the problem. And this is an interior code. It's not an atmosphere code. And I didn't have a way, and I still don't, to follow the mass loss of those outer layers beyond the photosphere. But something is going on in these to cause this, you know, sudden, it's trying to get going, pulsating, but all of a sudden, this photosphere has gotten kicked, and it's going out. So what I found, or what we found by looking at into the zones in this star, is that these deeper zones around that iron bump, they can exceed the Eddington limit during a pulsation cycle. If you get them started pulsating in some mode, a radial fundamental or first overtone, during the pulsation cycle, sometimes they can exceed the Eddington limit. And then they get maybe a push due to this radiation pressure. And in a static model, what you would normally have happen is that you would have some convection treatment where convection would instantaneously adapt to carry the energy if it was trying to get out in that iron region where convection could get started. So it would instantaneously carry it, and then you would never get this kind of instability in a regular static model. But if you have a time-dependent convection treatment and your pulsation cycle is comparable to the convective time scale, then convection really doesn't just turn on instantaneously. It takes a while to get going to carry that energy. So during that part of the pulsation cycle in that zone, the zone can exceed the Eddington limit. And that is what was going on in these models. So this is a really ragged picture of one particular zone, and things are moving around. But what you see here is the convective luminosity in that zone, and it's going up and down depending on this pulsation that's trying to get started. And you see the Eddington luminosity in blue here, and you see green is the radiative luminosity. So the right here, the convective luminosity has exceeded the Eddington limit. Anytime the green goes above, it's exceeded the Eddington limit. So if I blow up that region with where it's had this exceeding spot, see convection is, the convective luminosity is turning on here, and here the radiative luminosity has exceeded the Eddington limit, and convection wants to turn on, but it's lagging. It's taking a while for it to turn on so that all the luminosity isn't exceeding the Eddington luminosity because the convective time scale is shorter. And this kind of lagging happens in lower mass stars as well, but they never exceed the Eddington limit in those cases, like the 30 or the 20 solar mass stars. So what we found here is that for models near that Humphreys-Davidson limit, pulsations can grow to large amplitudes. The periods and amplitudes can be similar to the LBV microduration in 5 or 50 day periods. And if the convective time scale, which is comparable to the pulsation period, you need to have a time-dependent convection treatment And when the convection can't compensate to carry the luminosity fast enough, you can get that layer exceeding the Eddington limit. So that may expand the envelope. It may cause these pushes in different layers and maybe lead to mass loss. So I think this mechanism, though, can really really tell you only a little bit more about what might be happening in an LBV star with winds of around 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year, where pulsation may enhance the mass loss. But I haven't followed it all. But for a giant eruption like Eta Carina or P-Sig, you need a lot more mass ejected than 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year. You might need more like a solar mass per year. And these mechanisms seem to turn on very suddenly and then maybe turn off for hundreds or thousands of years. And there might even be a rebound in about 50 or 100 years after the first explosion. And these generate a lot of energy. And you need a lot of energy to get that much mass out of a very deep potential well. So we've done, well, here's some pictures of some stars that have done rebounds. Have you seen these before? Eta Carina had this rebound about 50 years later after its big eruption. P. Cygni looks like it has had such a thing. I don't want to run too much over. Supernova 1961b was probably not a supernova, possibly. It had an eruption afterwards, and this V12 and NGC 2403. So they seem to have this rebound going on. So if this is just a cartoon, but if you look at a 50 solar mass model, almost all the mass is way down here at 6.5 solar radii, whereas the star is out at 130 at the photosphere solar radii. And hydrogen burning shell is only at about 2 solar radii, so it's way in here. So I think that to get a couple solar masses out of this down here, you're really going to need a lot of energy. And it's got to be deposited way down in here, so not way out at the surface. What I did is calculated that you needed about 0.002 solar masses of hydrogen converted into helium. So if you maybe had a hydrogen-burning shell and you could convert that quickly into helium, you would need that much converted in order to lift that material out of the potential well. So I'm thinking about mechanisms that might cause some kind of event down in the hydrogen-burning shell outside of the helium-burning core. And this is also a cartoon, but some kind of mixing right at that boundary between the helium core and the hydrogen-burning shell. Maybe a gravity mode that is sloshing material and sloshes something into the core, and then it causes this eruption and matter gets ejected, and then it has to fall back in and recover. And the recovery might take about 50 years or so. But what other kinds of mechanisms could there be? And these are some other questions for you. So I put up gravity mode mixing. Maybe that doesn't work. People have talked about the epsilon mechanism for pulsations. And could there be some kind of an extreme epsilon mechanism going on in these cores that causes this? Could there be tidal forcing of a binary companion that causes a mixing episode? This subject is one I've been looking at this week, the subject of secular instability. And I wondered if anyone has heard of secular instabilities. They're talked about in disks. They're talked about in white dwarfs and neutron stars in the literature. But I don't think people have revisited these kinds of stars for a long time. Or maybe they have, and they're just called something else. And these are instabilities on a thermal timescale, the Kelvin-Helmholtz timescale. And instead of doing the normal pulsation analysis to look for modes on a dynamical timescale, instead you look for modes where the star is in hydrostatic equilibrium but not in thermal equilibrium. And I also wondered if some kind of mechanism like SASE, where you've got an accretion shock, could play a role in the big ejections. So this is the paper that I was looking at some this week, and there's many, many more in the literature by Carl Hansen, Secular Stability Application to Stellar Structure and Evolution. It's 1978. And they didn't do very many stellar pulsation models, and they had some two-zone models where they were investigating this and some theoretical models. But as far as I could tell, they kind of wrapped up their analytical work around 1980, and this subject hadn't really been finished. One of the problems was that these equations were too hard to solve, and the solutions were not self-adjoint, the matrix, and they didn't know if they had a complete set of eigenfunctions and eigenvalues for the solutions they could get. So they were never quite sure if they'd found everything there was to be found. And this is the equation where they basically, this is the non-adiabatic wave equation from Cox and Julie, and they just throw out this term from the dynamical part and solve this equation for, try to solve it anyway for this eigenfunction in those frequencies and see if they can get something. And so my questions about secular instabilities, if anyone knows anything about them, have they already been fully explored for massive stars? Do we actually see them in AGB star thermal pulses? Are those a manifestation of secular instability? Are pulsation amplitude variations, those slow variations in amplitude we sometimes see in like the Kepler data, are those caused by a secular instability? Do we ignore them because the time scale is too short for evolution calculations, like thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, or and too long for pulsation calculations or hydrodynamics calculations? They fall somewhere in the middle, so maybe we're just ignoring them or factoring them out in our simulations. Do we actually assume thermal equilibrium in stellar evolution calculations? And if we took short enough time steps in our evolution code, would we see these instabilities? Maybe the helium core flash is an example of a secular instability. So if anyone has answers to these questions, I would love to hear them.
Well, to the last 2 points, I mean, we don't assume thermal equilibrium, right?
We don't assume thermal equilibrium. Okay.
Should show up.
So it should show up if we take the short time steps. Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think with the second one, can we distinguish secular instabilities from these numerical effects that Richard and Anne were talking about?
I was wondering about that too. You know, Anne was saying, well, if I make my time step really short, you get these funny pulses, and that's a numerical artifact.
That's completely numerical. That's clearly numerical. I think, yeah, we could distinguish them from numerical effects like that. The reason why, I mean, secular instabilities can potentially be revealed in linear oscillation codes, but linear oscillation codes often are geared up to look for the non-adiabatic counterparts of adiabatic solutions, and secular instabilities don't have adiabatic counterparts, so mm-hmm. you don't find them, so you...
So we don't look for them.
So we don't look for them, basically. Mm-hmm. But there's no reason why they cannot be looked for. Mm-hmm. It's just that the way things are set up, we usually don't look for them. So I've seen stable secular modes in my simulations using Gaia. But I've never looked for an unstable secular modes.
Okay. Is that worth doing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No reason why not.
Some crazy place in evolution.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Hansen and those guys said that on just a regular normal main sequence star, they couldn't find any unstable ones, but they were speculating that shell hydrogen burning stars and things could have these, right?
On the main sequence, the star's in thermal equilibrium, but post main sequence during shell burning, it's not, so that's where you would look.
Right, okay. Well, maybe that would be something worth doing. Okay. Any more answers, questions?
So I've run some MESA models with hydro after the main sequence, and sometimes they do crazy things. but I couldn't be certain if it's a numerical thing or a secular instability, but I've definitely seen runs where just the velocity all of a sudden gets really large, and I don't understand why. So it's possible.
How do we have models now of the helium core flash for lower mass stars? Evolution models.
Yep.
We have those now. And we just run right through them and no problem. Do they lose mass?
That's a good point. And you know, Dave Arnett has also been talking about that forever. Mm-hmm. And what we have not done is try to take the really small time steps and follow it to see if we're launching any kind of a dynamic event during that helium core flash. And it's quite possible we're just damping it out, as you say, with the time steps we're allowing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
I think we're at the point where the tools are there to do that. we just, that's one of the many things on the list that hasn't been done.
I think the problem is convection.
Convection.
The whole issue of...
Yeah, the one thing I have learned at this conference is that it seems like you need 3D models to do some of the dynamical things right, and then make turning it into a 1D approximation is not that easy. Like this porosity, that if that isn't included, that will change. That's going to change how energy gets out. And my time-dependent convection treatment is assuming these shells are sitting there getting radiated, and convection's going to take over, but convection may only take over sporadically in different places, and it's going to change the whole structure. So having a 3D model is really important. Yeah.
Well, I'm confused with the secular instability. So generally, so I've looked at this with a neutron star case. Okay. These are not radial modes. These are usually like L equal 1 or something higher. How do you do this in 1D?
Well, the papers in 78 were assuming they were radial modes. Okay. That's all they could do. So in the neutron stars, they're non-radial modes that you find. Yeah, so that's a whole other layer on this, is should you do a non-radial non-radial analysis of it. Yeah. Neutron stars, white dwarfs have been looked at.
Yes, something else. Okay. Why was the helium abundance so important for getting your large forces or not?
It seemed like if I put more helium in the opacity overall of that envelope was lower. And
the second bump, I mean, your calculations are part of iron bumps.
Right, right.
Then you have a second bump, the helium bump.
Right, but that didn't really cause any pulsation driving. No. But it did change the structure of the envelope and maybe added some radiative damping, but it seemed like more helium damped down the amplitudes of the pulsations for me.
I mean, the electron scattering opacity just by itself depends on the helium abundance. So there's less electrons with more helium.
Yeah, there's less electrons with more helium, and that's maybe the first order what's going on. But the opacity was lower, so they exceeded the Eddington limit less easily when there was more helium in the mixture. Anything, any more ideas, suggestions? I think that this cause of the massive eruptions is a really big question. And Stan, you know, had a thing where you just deposit energy somehow. That's more for a wind. That wasn't for the giant eruption. But I think that matter is really deep in that star, and getting a couple solar masses out of that potential well is going to take something big. Yeah, so. All right, thank you for your time. All right, I guess I've had